It is Friday, November the 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, searching for a path to peace in Afghanistan.
There's a lot of confusion at the moment, I think, here in Kabul, and also concern and worry as well.
U.S.-China relations and why President Trump did not go to that APEC summit.
Presidents like to show up when they think there's going to be some, you know, glory to be reaped from this. And that clearly was not the case with APEC.
Also ahead, the value of foreign students to the U.S., plus some sounds from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump says his administration is conducting very strong peace negotiations in Afghanistan, but that he's not sure whether they will be successful. He made the remarks during a teleconference call with U.S. troops stationed in Afghanistan. The president said service members in that country have done what he calls an incredible job.
Your courage truly inspires us all. We know what you're doing, and we watch it. You know, oftentimes, we're watching it every night during the news, and we know it's dangerous, and we also know that you've had an unbelievable impact.
About 14,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Afghanistan. They're there to conduct operations to train and advise Afghan security forces in their battle against the Taliban and to conduct separate operations against terrorist groups such as the Islamic State. Meantime, Afghan Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah, recently arriving in Kabul from France, had told the French press agency the Taliban insurgency has not yet shown any signs that it's serious about ending the 17-year war. Nazif Shirani is an anthropologist and Middle Eastern and Central Asian cultures professor at Indiana University. He's currently in Kabul and tells VOA's Victor Beatty there is a concern among Afghan officials they are not being given ownership of the peace negotiations.
And also there's a general concern on the part of not only government but civil society and other interested organs in society that the negotiation terms or the process is not open, it's not transparent. They don't know what's being negotiated and on their behalf. So there's a lot of concerns, and I think maybe Mr. Khalilzad is under pressure from President Trump to show results quickly. But the claims he has made has been also rejected by Taliban, saying, no, they didn't say that, they didn't agree to that. So there's a lot of confusion at the moment, I think, here in Kabul, and also concern and worries as well.
As you know, the Taliban's own assessment of the meeting last week in Qatar was that there was no agreement on any subject, so they're sounding somewhat pessimistic.
That's absolutely right. But on the other side, there is surfacing of some supposedly suggestions on their part that the presidential election, which is scheduled for April, should be postponed, and that some kind of interim government should be formed in which supposedly the Taliban will be, you know, taking part. And they have also floated a bunch of names of people who could be on that government or head the government, some such. So there are plenty of things being thrown around, but no confirmation or affirmation of it, but plenty of discussions here in Kabul.
At the same time this week, the Pentagon's Inspector General said that in his quarterly report that little progress has been made with regard to the security situation and progress toward peace remains elusive.
Well, absolutely true. In fact, not only militarily, they have not made any progress despite sending more troops and more maybe equipment, who knows, that more territories are being threatened. Especially in central Afghanistan, in the Hazara district, there's been a lot of fighting there in this location, and government has not been capable of going into the field and protecting the area. There are demands for community self-policing and resistance, and that they should be equipped, and that is not happening. There's lots of war going on in Farah province near the Iranian border. There's a threat against areas that were considered to be safe earlier, certain districts have increased enormously, so that there is a worry that maybe Taliban before any kind of peace or wish to grab more territory or influence or show themselves to be more credible. And, of course, Russians are trying to promote that as well.
Nazif Shirani is an anthropologist, also Middle Eastern and Central Asians culture professor at Indiana University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. President Trump has resumed his public dispute with the U.S. High Court Chief Justice John Roberts, all of this over the independence of the American judiciary. AP's Mike Kempen is following the story.
The president's latest criticism takes aim at California's 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which long has had a majority of judges appointed by Democratic presidents. Trump this morning tweeted that Roberts, quote, can say what he wants, but the 9th Circuit is a complete and total disaster, unquote. Earlier this week, Trump was critical of a judge appointed by President Obama who rejected his migrant asylum policy. Roberts responded on Wednesday with a statement saying there are no Obama judges or Trump judges, but instead an extraordinary group of dedicated judges. Mike Hempen, Washington.
President Trump also is threatening to close the U.S. border with Mexico. That story now from AP's Ed Donahue.
Migrants are camping out in Tijuana, Mexico at the border. They have traveled there from Central America.
They have records. They have some very substantial criminal records, some very bad criminal records.
The president says it's a really bad situation there.
They have fistfights all over the streets. They're starting fistfights. They said these are not like normal, innocent people.
And if it's determined Mexico can't control it, the president says the U.S. will shut down the border.
The whole border. I mean the whole border.
And how far will the military go?
If they have to, they're going to use lethal force. I've given the okay. Yeah, if they have to, I hope they don't have to.
The president says he has no choice because you are dealing with rough people. Ed Donahue, Washington.
And still ahead on International Edition, ongoing tensions between Washington and Beijing. This is VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, general elections are coming up in the Democratic Republic of Congo on December 23rd to determine a successor to President Joseph Kabila. An in-depth discussion on what's at stake in DRC's elections on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Trump administration says China has failed to alter its unfair, their words, practice at the heart of the U.S.-China trade conflict at the recent APEC summit. Phil Levy of the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman the lack of results in the APEC, the APEC, will make things more complicated for both President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping when they meet in Argentina.
It did not seem like a diplomatic success, and it also did not seem like it was setting the stage for any quick resolution of the conflict between the United States and China. If anything, Vice President Pence, who had a long career as a free trader, has seemed to be the voice of entrenched opposition to China.
Why do you think that is? Was that set up that way, that he went instead of Trump? Is there an intentional move, as far as you are concerned, about taking a very strong sense against China? And how is China reacting to that?
Presidents like to show up when they think there's going to be some, you know, glory to be reaped from this. And that clearly was not the case with APEC, that this was going to be conflict and, you know, being chastised by someone. And if you're president, that's when you think, I'll send the vice president in my stead. I think what we're seeing here is, particularly in the approach that Vice President Pence has taken, you're not only getting the litany of economic complaints about China, but they're also getting tinged with serious national security concerns. The important point about that is it's going to make it very hard for this administration to reverse course with any speed.
Is that not the case for China, as their very strong sense by Xi Jinping? Is it not almost the same situation?
Well, I think one of the ways to interpret China's reaction to all this was those who had hypothesized that China would be vulnerable, that China's economy was shaky, that China was going to be desperate to have a quick resolution, were probably disabused of that notion, that you cannot slap China in the face like this and expect them to simply surrender. They didn't. They took a strong stand. They tried to claim the high ground as the defender of the multilateral trading system. There's a fair bit of irony in that. But rhetorically, it puts them in a somewhat stronger position given the attacks on the system that the Trump administration has put forward.
Now, we move on to the next coming weeks when the meeting between Trump and Xi is at least scheduled on the sidelines in Buenos Aires. How do you think this prelude to that meeting will affect that meeting?
I certainly don't think the results of APEC bode well. Ideally, if you are going to have a successful summit between heads of state, you have months at least of background work by lower level officials that would not usually be at the vice presidential level, but lower still, who are working out all the details, teeing everything up, and leaving a few key issues to be resolved. As far as I know, there are some meetings that are starting to happen, but we haven't seen the kind of preparatory work that usually will lead to a successful summit, even if we were talking about relatively mundane issues. And the kind of things on the agenda between the U.S. and China are not mundane, nor are they easy.
So what kind of pitfalls does that raise?
It means that you could have a repeat of the G20 of the kind of conflict that we saw at APEC, where it's not open hostility, of course, but it's kind of chilly.
So what happens now? What happens if your assessment and your prediction of the possibility of the meeting in Buenos Aires to end up like APEC, where does it leave the situation?
Well, this would be China sort of calling President Trump's bluff, perhaps, that the president has kind of hinted to farmers and others who are suffering from Chinese retaliation that a deal is around the corner, the end is in sight, don't worry, hang on, you'll sell those crops after all. If you don't have a deal, I don't think soybean crops can sit forever in the fields or in the silos. And meanwhile, the president has committed $200 billion of imports from China from 10% to 25% as of January 1st, and that's coming up soon.
Phil Leiby is a senior fellow at the Global Economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He teaches in the Strategy Department at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and he was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
International students in the United States bring billions of dollars and thousands of jobs to the nation's economy and remain an important diplomatic key to global diplomacy. But as VOA's Kathleen Strzok tells us, many students are starting to feel that they might be looking elsewhere around the world for higher education.
The U.S. remains the top destination in the world, hosting more than 1 million college students. That's twice as many students as Britain, which ranks second. Education experts say after 10 years on the rise, applications are now dropping because of the high price of tuition and the current political climate.
I don't know if you're aware, but the United States has consistently attracted about a quarter of the international students globally. That's pretty amazing.
But those numbers are declining, according to the latest annual report from the Institute of International Education in Washington.
There's a slower rate of students coming into the U.S. There was a sharp decline of over 6%. And so this is an indication of several factors.
Experts attribute the drop not just to cost in politics, but also to anxiety over immigration, trouble getting visas, and student safety. Some students say they feel unwelcome in the U.S., something other countries are capitalizing on, including Canada, China, Australia, New Zealand, and Europe.
For me personally, I had to wait 10 months to get my visa. They accept your visa or reject it, or they tell you, like, oh, wait.
Safety is also a top concern for foreign students when considering higher education in the U.S. Recent incidents have fueled that fear.
Last year, I think a couple of Indians were killed in Kansas, I think. They were mistaken for Middle Easterners. And that was a big news in India, and that caused not just a bit of a diplomatic row, but also that, hey, you know, what's happening? Are we safe? And for Sikh students, you know, regularly get mistaken for Muslims, and, you know, are victims of hate crimes.
While the U.S. is statistically safe for students, international news coverage of such events has caused some students to think twice about studying in the U.S. Meanwhile, the U.S. government says international education remains a pillar of its economic and diplomatic efforts.
Just last year, international students contributed over $42 billion to the United States economy and supported over 450,000 United States jobs. That's pretty incredible. This two-way relationship is beneficial to our national security. The Trump administration is charting a new course for U.S. foreign policy, which includes the promotion of America's national security interests through educational and cultural exchanges.
Educators say they have stepped up efforts to recruit foreign students and assure them that they are welcome in the U.S. Kathleen Strzok, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead, the sounds of Patty Austin and James Ingram. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
November 20th marked what could be considered the 20th anniversary of the International Space Station. It was on that day in 1998 that the Zarya Functional Cargo Block, the first module of what would become the ISS, was launched into space atop a Russian rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. According to NASA, Zarya, which means sunrise in Russian, was a self-contained unit that provided power, communications, and served as a temporary control room during the early construction phase of the ISS. It's now primarily used as a storage area. 16 days later, the Space Shuttle Endeavour, carrying the second ISS module, the Unity Node 1, in its cargo bay, rendezvoused with Zarya, and its crew mated the two modules together. Over the next 13 years, 13 more modules were added to the space station. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
Thinking back in time when love was only in my mind, I realize ain't no second chance. You got to hold on to romance, don't let it slide. There's a special kind of magic in the air when you find another heart that needs to share.
Today we're hearing from one of the most amazing duets of all times. Patty Austin is a Grammy Award-winning American R&B, pop, and jazz singer. James Ingram is an American singer, songwriter, record producer, and instrumentalist. Baby Come to Me was one of their most popular collaborations.
Because there's a brand new
Austin was born in 1950 in Harlem in New York City and grew up in Bayshore on Long Island. Quincy Jones and Dinah Washington have referred to themselves as her godparents. James Ingram was born in 1952 in Akron, Ohio. He lived with his mother and father until he was 10 years old, then moved in with his grandmother, and later moved to Los Angeles and played with the band Revelation Funk. He also played keyboards for Ray Charles before becoming famous. In 1981, Austin and Ingram took to the stage with record producer, musician, and composer Quincy Jones to perform I Know Corrida, covered by Jones on his album The Dude. Jones's version peaked at number 28 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 10 on the R&B chart. Patti Austin and James Ingram have done lots of duets, but none have been as popular with their fans as How Do You Keep the Music Playing?
How do you keep the music playing? How do you make it last? How do you keep the song from fading too fast?
How do you lose yourself to someone and never lose your way? To say,
in 2000, Patti Austin was awarded an honorary doctorate of music from Berklee College of Music in Boston alongside trumpeter and producer Herb Alpert. Austin is always outperforming everywhere, all the time, doing lots of jazz and many of her longtime hits. And James Ingram is perhaps best known for his hit collaborations with other vocalists, such as Patti Austin and Linda Ronstadt, and like Austin, is out on the road always touring and performing before thousands of fans.
I know the way I feel for you, it's now or never.
The more I love, the more that I'm afraid that in your eyes I may not see forever.
If we can be the best of lovers, yeah, be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, with any luck, then I suppose the music never
ends. You know, I've got lots of favorite singers, but I think these two together, amazing, fantastic. Patti Austin, James Ingram. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Patti Austin and James Ingram.
If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better, as it grows,
with any luck, then I suppose
the music never ends.
How do you keep it playing, baby? Oh,
oh, oh.
I wanna know.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
Earth and Sky.
The discovery that chimpanzees use tools to dig up edible tubers might help us understand our human origins better.
Anthropologist Jim Moore of the University of California, San Diego, studies chimps in the Ugala region of Tanzania. A 2007 study that he helped guide provides the first evidence that chimps use tools to forage for tubers.
A lot of models of human evolution have emphasized the importance of some kind of technology that allows us to do things that other animals, other primates anyway, haven't been able to do. And one of those, and probably a central one, is the use of sticks to dig up roots and tubers.
Tubers such as sweet potatoes and cassava were important foods for early hominids. Moore told Earth and Sky that the Ugala chimps forage for tubers in much the same way as our human ancestors might have.
Finding chimpanzees doing a very primitive, a very simplified version of this presents us with a sort of a way of understanding how that behavior that's so important to modern human foragers could have got started.
It's a finding that, Moore said, complicates the line between human and non-human, but that might help us understand our own origins.
It gives us a way of studying the behavioral side of the origin of something that was critical in allowing us to expand around the world and allowing us to become who we are.
We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
VOA News.